Folks, we have a little more than 5 weeks left in 2015, and we need approximately $100,000 to cover our expenses for the year. Please consider making a year-end tax-deductible gift to support this worldwide outreach. You can contribute by check, make your check payable to Issues Etc., and send it to Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also make a secure online donation at issuesetc.org. Thanks for listening, and thanks for thinking of us at the end of 2015. They have sadly kind of been reduced to cartoon characters or characters intended to market something to us, especially around the day that we call Thanksgiving. We trace it back to the Mayflower Pilgrims, and rightly so, but who were they? What were their religious sensibilities? What were their political sensibilities? What did they come here for? Was it for religious freedom, or was it some other reason? And what was this day that we celebrate now as Thanksgiving that they celebrated perhaps in a slightly different way? On this Wednesday afternoon, November the 26th, we're going to be talking about the Mayflower Pilgrims. Pastor David J. Weber will be our guest. Greetings and welcome to Issues, Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. After our conversation with Pastor Weber, we will discuss the Lord's Prayer, the petition, Give Us This Day Our Daily Bread. Pastor Peter Bender of the Concordia Catechetical Academy will be our guest. Pastor David J. Weber is a regular guest. He's pastor of Redeemer Lutheran Church in Scottsdale, Arizona. David, welcome back to Issues, Etc.
Thank you. I'm glad to be with you.
First of all, why should someone listening to us bother to listen to a Lutheran pastor on the subject of the Mayflower Pilgrims?
I suppose one of the reasons would be because I'm an American Lutheran pastor, and the Mayflower and Pilgrim story is the quintessential American story. These were misfits and dreamers from the old world who had come to the belief that in the new world, through their hard work and ingenuity, they could make a better life for themselves, for their children, and for their descendants. And that's the American story. And so any American should be interested in their story. But I suppose another reason would be because the pilgrims from the Mayflower do have approximately 1 million descendants in the world today. And both my wife and I are among those descendants. And so not only is the pilgrim story the story of my country, it's also the story of my family. And for that reason, I've always been interested in learning about that story.
Let's talk about their religious sensibilities. Often we hear the term pilgrims, Mayflower Pilgrims, and Puritans referred to as essentially the same thing. Who were the Puritans, and how does that inform our understanding of the Mayflower Pilgrims?
The Mayflower Pilgrims were from the general milieu of the Puritan movement in England. Now, the Puritans believed that the English Reformation was incomplete. Theologically, they were inspired mostly by Calvinism, but they also did have some unique features. For example, they had much more of an experiential piety, emphasizing the need for an inner testimony and an inner experiencing of one's election and regeneration, and also emphasizing the need for a personal faith, more so perhaps than a typical continental Calvinist would. In fact, in New England in later years, once the Pilgrims and Puritans had established communities and congregations there, admission to membership in a New England congregational church depended on the ability to give a persuasive account of this kind of inner religious experience. It's also interesting from a Lutheran context that Philip Jakob Spener, the founder of the Pietist movement within Lutheranism, had read Puritan devotional and theological books in his earlier years, and those books were quite influential on him. And so in a certain sense, the Puritan movement was a mother movement that fed into the later movement of Pietism within Lutheranism. Now, the Puritans, especially the non-conforming Puritan clergy in England, were harassed by the bishops, but they were not outrightly persecuted, and that's because they did remain basically within the structure of the state church. But they were sometimes harassed and sometimes removed from office at times when things would come to a head. For example, the flashpoint would often be whether or not the minister would be willing to wear a surplice when he conducted a service and whether or not he would be willing to make the sign of the cross when he baptized a baby. The strict Puritan clergy were not willing to do those things, and so often they would be deposed from office. But deposing from office was pretty much the worst punishment that the Puritans experienced in the late 1500s and early 1600s. It's also among the Puritans in England during this time in history where those myths originated that Christian holidays, such as Christmas and Easter, were actually pagan in origin and should not be observed. And so the Puritan agenda for further reform in the Church of England called for a more pronounced Calvinism and public doctrine, and also that there would be no set days of worship, no Christian holidays except for the Sunday Sabbath. They also did not want there to be any liturgical forms that were not specifically called for in the Bible, and they didn't want there to be the singing of freely composed hymns. They thought that only psalms and psalm paraphrases should be sung. Now, as I said, this was the general milieu from which the Mayflower Pilgrims emerged. But from this milieu, a smaller group of separatists did eventually reach the conclusion that the Church of England as an institution was unreformable. And so they broke away and rejected the whole concept of a state church, whether it would be Anglican or Puritan or whatever. They broke away and they established independent and illegal congregations. And the separatists were persecuted. Because at that time in history in England, as with most of the countries in Europe, there was no toleration for the public practicing of a dissenting religion. And so they did become the object of the attention of the authorities. They were spied on. They were often arrested and were overtly persecuted. Compared to the mainstream Puritans, I suppose we could say that these separatists were less tolerant of the Church of England as an institution, but interestingly enough, they were more tolerant of individuals who perhaps had not yet come to see things their way. And another major difference was that they had come to embrace a strongly congregational or covenantal church polity as compared to the Presbyterian church polity that mainstream Puritanism had wanted to introduce within the Church of England. Now, King James, of course, was not sympathetic at all with the separatists. And in fact, he famously said on one occasion, "I will make them conform themselves, or else I will harry them out of the land, or else do worse." And so they took that sort of as an invitation that maybe they should just leave England. But the interesting thing is that when they tried to leave, he and his officials stopped them. But eventually they did relent. And so in 1609, a sizable group of these separatists did leave England. They migrated to Holland, where there was religious toleration, and they established an independent English-speaking congregation there. And that group is the group that became known in history as the Pilgrims. One of the major theological influences on that group was their pastor, John Robinson. John Robinson himself never had the opportunity to come to America and settle in the Plymouth colony because he passed away before he had an opportunity to do that. But his son did later come to Plymouth, and so therefore he does have descendants in America. His influence was such that he taught them to be very respectful of the authority of Scripture and very submissive to the authority of Scripture, but yet he also taught them to be tolerant of individuals and patient with individuals who perhaps had not yet come to see things in the way that they had. He also had a more generous opinion regarding the possibility of people outside of the pale of his separatist and Puritan movement being able to be Christians. In fact, he even believed that it was possible for people in the Roman Church to be Christians. In that highly polemical age, that was an unusual position, but yet that was his position. And so he did exercise a more enlightened influence, we might say, on the people who were members of that congregation in Leiden. And after a while, it included not only the original group, but many other Englishmen who had similarly migrated from England to Holland and affiliated with that congregation. So the Pilgrims were happy in Holland in the sense that they were able to practice their religion without any persecution. Even though the Dutch Reformed Church was the official state religion of the Netherlands, they were tolerated, as were many other religious groups, and so they were satisfied in that respect. However, in other ways, they were not happy in Leiden. In England, most of them had been farmers and were fairly prosperous. But in Leiden, as foreigners, the jobs that they were able to get were, for the most part, low-level jobs in the textile industry. So they were always living on the edge of poverty, and they were doing work that they really did not enjoy, and so they were not happy about it. Maybe one exception would be William Brewster, who was the elder of the congregation, second in authority after Pastor Robinson. He was a partner in the running of a secret printing press in Leiden. He would print various tracts and books that would be promoting the separatist and congregational principles, and these books would be smuggled into England and would be circulated and would be kind of an ongoing thorn in the flesh of the king and his bishops. But in general, the pilgrims were not happy in Leiden. They also were not happy with what they perceived to be the worldliness of the Dutch people. And when they saw their children, after a while, becoming more Dutch in their ways and mannerisms and culture, then they were alarmed that perhaps they were losing some of the high ideals of their English religion than what they wanted to lose.
Pastor David J. Weber is our guest. We're talking about the Mayflower Pilgrims on this Wednesday afternoon. It's the 26th of November. He's pastor of Redeemer Lutheran Church in Scottsdale, Arizona, and both he and his wife are descendants from the Mayflower Pilgrims. When we come back, the picture that we've had painted so far for us right now might help us revise a little bit of the inaccuracies of our romanticized history of the Mayflower Pilgrims. It was not specifically for religious freedom that they emigrated, but for some other reasons, and we'll talk about that after this.
There are nearly 20 million college students in the United States. 40% will stop going to church during college. 50% will never return. The Lutheran Church Missouri Synod is seeking to meet this challenge through LCMSU. Why? Because 100% of college students matter to God and to His church. College is tough. You need Jesus. We'll help. LCMSU. Check us out at lcms.org/lcmsu.
Hollywood's attitude toward Christianity, the Bible's influence on the U.S. Constitution, the decline of biblical preaching, the connection between biblical illiteracy and Western morality. You'll find these essays and more in the new book, The Word They Still Shall Let Remain, The Place of the Holy Scriptures in the Faith and Life of Confessional Lutherans. Check it out at shop.logia.org. The Word They Still Shall Let Remain, shop.logia.org.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Christ Jesus, the image of the invisible God. For unto us a child is born. The titles of Christ, Good News of Great Joy, the Magnificat. These are some of the Christ-focused themes offered by Ad Crucem this Christmas. Shop adcrucem.com for greeting cards, gifts, housewares, ornaments, music, and much, much more. Available from adcrucem.com, confessing the faith through word and art. Adcrucem.com, adcrucem.com.
No gimmicks, no shticks, just straightforward preaching and teaching in accord with Scripture and the Lutheran confessions. By the book liturgy, right from the hymnal. No glitz, just Christ crucified for sinners like us. We're Grace Lutheran Church in Racine, Wisconsin. Come receive God's gifts with us. Find out more about us at gracelutheranracine, that's all one word, .net. And like you, we're proud supporters of Issues, Etc.
Welcome back to Issues, Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. On this day in advance of Thanksgiving Day, we're remembering the Mayflower Pilgrims with Pastor David J. Weber, pastor of Redeemer Lutheran Church in Scottsdale, Arizona. He and his wife are direct descendants of the Mayflower Pilgrims. From what you told us before, it sounds like they already enjoyed a certain amount, in fact, a pretty good amount of religious freedom or tolerance in Holland. So what were the reasons they decided to emigrate to the New World?
Yes. They did not come to America for religious freedom. They had the freedom to practice their religion according to their conscience in the Netherlands. But there were four reasons that were given for their desire to come to the New World. The first one would be for security, because there was a very genuine fear that warfare between Spain and the Netherlands would resume, and they knew that they did not want to be in the middle of that kind of a conflict. The second reason was because they wanted to establish a Christian English society. As I noted, they were not really happy with what they perceived to be the worldliness of the Dutch people. They wanted to establish a society that would reflect their values as Christian Englishmen. And they had the idea, too, that once the people in England could see that such a society could be established, then they were hopeful that the people in England would reform themselves and become that kind of a society. The third reason, which they gave, was because they wanted to bring the gospel to the native people in America. They knew that there were people in the New World who had not heard the gospel, and they did want to proclaim the gospel to them. This was something that John Robinson especially emphasized as one of the important reasons for the establishment of the colony. And then the fourth reason was to provide for themselves and for their children and descendants opportunity for land ownership and for economic advancement that they simply did not have in Europe. As I said before, most of them were farmers. They wanted to return to an agricultural livelihood, and they also wanted to make opportunities for themselves and their family in the New World that would not be possible to do anywhere else. And so those were the reasons that they came. And, of course, many of those reasons are reasons why immigrants of all succeeding generations also came. That's why they boarded the famous ship, the Mayflower, and crossed over the Atlantic Ocean. The Mayflower itself was not able to depart at exactly the time when they had originally hoped. They departed later in the season in 1620, and so they departed during a time when there were more storms in the North Atlantic, and that did create somewhat of a problem for them. But yet there was also a benefit to crossing on the Mayflower. The Mayflower had not previously been used for passengers. Remember that this was before the time when there really was a need for passenger ships. There was previously an English colony in Jamestown, but there were not high numbers of people who were being transported to and from that colony. And so they improvised with a ship that previously had been used for the transportation of wine. And this was an advantage because such a ship would be described as a sweet ship. In other words, it smelled nice. It had been able to withstand the noxious odors that often would develop in the wood of ships that transported other things. And so they were happy to be on a ship that smelled sweet, relatively speaking. And an interesting story, too, since we're talking about the passage, is the story of John Howland, who was a young man who was among the pilgrims. During one of these storms, he got curious to see what it would look like and to see the crashing waves coming over the side of the ship. And so he went out on the deck where he was not supposed to be and pretty quickly got swept overboard by a wave. And it just so happens that there was a loose lanyard rope that was hanging down the side of the ship into the water, and he brushed up against that and grabbed onto it so that he didn't drown. He was several fathoms below the surface of the water, actually, so he came very close to drowning. But the fact that he fell overboard was noticed by some of the other men on the ship, and so they went over and they pulled him up and basically at the last second were able to save him and bring him back on board the ship. And I guess from a Christian perspective, that story teaches us a little something about God's providence and God's protection. And also, it teaches us a little bit about how small blessings from God can often result in many great things in the future. Because John Howland, at the time of this incident where he almost died by drowning, he was a single man. But because he was saved, he was able to go on to get married, to have children, and to have descendants. If he had never been able to do that, then his descendants would never have lived in the world, and the history of the entire world would be completely different, because John Howland was a direct ancestor of both Presidents Bush, Franklin D. Roosevelt, Sarah Palin, Dr. Benjamin Spock, Bing Crosby, Ralph Waldo Emerson, Henry Wadsworth Longfellow, the hymn writer Phillips Brooks, who wrote O Little Town of Bethlehem, the actors Christopher Lloyd, Humphrey Bogart, Chevy Chase, and the Baldwin brothers, and he's a direct ancestor of my wife, my children, and my grandchildren. None of those people ever would have lived if he had not been rescued when he fell overboard during the Mayflower's crossing.
So how many people all said made that Mayflower crossing? And I take it that not all of them were they were all Mayflower pilgrims, but they were not all of the, you know, this group of religious separatists. There were others who were brought along for other reasons. Talk about that, if you would.
Besides the master and the crew, there were 102 passengers. About half of them were from the Leiden congregation. They were from that. They were the core group from those pilgrims who had gone from England to Leiden in 1609 and then were going to America in 1620. But about half were people who had been recruited by the merchant adventurers. The merchant adventurers were Englishmen centered mostly in London who were giving their money to invest in paying the costs of this trip and the costs of establishing the colony. And they recruited some people who would be able to fill out the ranks of the colony, providing certain skills that would be needed for the establishment of Plymouth that the Leiden separatists did not have. There were some interesting people in that group, too. One of them was a man named Stephen Hopkins, who actually was the only person among the settlers who had been to America before. In the year 1609, he had been on a ship called the Sea Venture, which was destined for the Jamestown colony. That ship got caught up in a hurricane and was shipwrecked with another ship on Bermuda. They had several different kinds of experiences there over several months, and eventually the survivors were able to piece together a functioning ship and did eventually make their way to Jamestown, where they arrived in 1610. And that's where Stephen Hopkins lived for several years. Now, an account of this storm and shipwreck was written and later published in England, and it's interesting that William Shakespeare read that account and then used it as the basis for his play, The Tempest. And so in The Tempest, the character Stefano is actually based on Stephen Hopkins, who was a passenger on the Sea Venture and who later was a passenger on the Mayflower. He had returned to England from Jamestown, and then in 1620, he brought his wife and his children to Plymouth, where he had the intention of staying permanently. When he was in Jamestown, he was intending to be there for a few years and then to go back to his family, but by 1620, he had decided he wanted to go to the New World and live there permanently. And that is, in fact, the unique thing about Plymouth as compared to Jamestown. Most of the people who went to Jamestown were men, and they went with the intention of staying only for a few years and then going back to England. Plymouth was different because it was settled by families, by husbands, wives, and children, and they intended to stay and establish a new permanent community and ultimately a new American society.
Did they view Plymouth as a British colony, as a Dutch colony? How did they understand their connection to the previous governments under which they'd lived?
Well, they understood that they were Englishmen, and in fact, they had the very overt desire to establish a distinctly English civilization that would be permeated by their Calvinist and Christian convictions. Their original destination was to the area that later became New York City, which was within the geographical region of the Virginia Colony Patent. And so originally they were going to be settling and living under the overall government of the Virginia Colony. But because of some nautical difficulties, they were not able to sail down there. And so the master of the Mayflower brought them to what later became New England instead. Now, New England was beyond the charter region of the Virginia colony. And so when they did finally decide that they were going to settle in New England, they needed to establish a government for themselves. They were not going to be under the Virginia government. And that's actually the origin of the Mayflower Compact, which is a very important document in our American history. Remember that the core group on the Mayflower were Congregationalists who believed in a covenantal church polity, meaning that individual members who had a common set of beliefs and a common religious experience would covenant together and establish a congregation committed to the fulfillment of common spiritual purposes. What happened among the Mayflower passengers is, according to their need to establish a a basis of civil authority, they kind of translated that principle to the civil realm. And they signed the Mayflower Compact, which was an agreement among all of the passengers, both the pilgrims from Leiden and those who had been recruited by the merchant adventurers, to abide by the laws that were passed by the group, to participate in elections, and to respect the authority of the people who were elected. Now, they did this clearly as Englishmen, and in the document they acknowledged King James of England as their sovereign, but yet it was also very different from the way things were set up in England. But yet it is not that much different from the way things are still set up in many towns in New England, because to this day, many towns in New England are governed in this way. There is town meeting day once a year where all of the residents of the town come together, they vote on civil matters, they elect their selectmen and other town leaders, and exercise a very congregational type of civil government. And that is a direct result of the precedent that was established by the Mayflower Pilgrims.
Can you explain, first of all, what they would have found when they arrived? Bear Beach, there on the northern end of what's today Massachusetts, and how in the world they survived?
When they arrived in what became New England, of course, there were no other English settlers there. There had been Englishmen who had come to that region as fishermen and as traders, but the region had never been settled, and so they were the only Englishmen living there. But they were not the only people living there, because the Wampanoag Indians were living in that area. There was one particular Indian, however, who was especially helpful to them. This was Tisquantum, whose diminutive name was Squanto, who is somebody who had actually had some bad experiences with the English in the past. There was one particular English sea captain who had come over and actually taken by force some Wampanoag Indians several years earlier, had brought them to Europe as slaves. And this, of course, left a very bad taste in the mouths of the Indian people of New England regarding the English. Squanto was one such person. He was taken into slavery in this way, was treated very unjustly, but yet he was rescued by some very decent people, some people who he would have recognized as decent Christian people, and eventually those people arranged for him to be sent back to his native land. Now, during the time when he was living in England, he learned the English language, and he also learned that there were some decent Englishmen, namely the ones who worked and managed to send him back to his homeland. So when the pilgrims arrived, he was able to make contact with them and serve them in two very important ways. First, he showed them the way in which crops should be planted in the soil of New England, how the crops should be fertilized and so forth, so that they would be able to have a bountiful and fruitful harvest. And he also was a very helpful go-between between the settlers and the other Wampanoag Indians. Squanto was able to make it clear to the Wampanoags that these Englishmen were not the nasty and dangerous kind that they had known before, who had kidnapped some of their young men, but these were decent people with whom they should establish friendly relations. And so through his influence, they were able to survive. They were able to plant crops that would grow in the soil and that would grow successfully, and they were able to establish friendly relations with the Indians of the area.
Pastor David J. Weber is our guest on this Wednesday afternoon, November the 26th. We're talking about the Mayflower Pilgrims. He and his wife are direct descendants of the Mayflower Pilgrims. He's also pastor of Redeemer Lutheran Church in Scottsdale, Arizona. More on the Mayflower Pilgrims and on their, well, we say survive, but how many actually survived the first year, we'll find out right after this.
Have you been too busy to get your associate's, bachelor's, or master's degree? Concordia University, Wisconsin offers 50 online educational options. Find out more at issuesetc.org. Click the Concordia University online logo and enter the program code ISSUES to waive your application fee. Concordia University, Wisconsin is here to strengthen and support the church. Lifelong Lutheran Learning. issuesetc.org and click Concordia University, Wisconsin online.
The 500th anniversary of the Lutheran Reformation is fast approaching. We have such a rich history as Lutherans, and many people don't realize that. The CLCC offers a seminar called Your Reformation Walk that teaches that rich heritage and helps you appreciate it. The CLCC also offers other seminars designed to help laity learn to appreciate what Lutherans believe, teach, and confess. So invite us to your church. Visit theclcc.org and get details on scheduling a seminar for your church today.
I chose to write about a choir director who's Lutheran and who's a big city girl but has moved to a small town.
Katie Schuerman talking about her new novel, The Choir Immortal.
I really wanted to address suffering in the present tense, this theology of the cross.
You can find out more about The Choir Immortal at issuesetc.org or by calling Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040. The Choir Immortal by Katie Schuerman.
LutheranReformation.org is the brand new one-stop shop for all things Reformation. It's your source for news, events, history, videos, activities, educational resources, and much, much more. New resources will be added regularly, each one designed to help you celebrate and remember the 500th anniversary of the Reformation. Because Reformation 2017 is still all about Jesus. Visit LutheranReformation.org today. LutheranReformation.org.
Education and edification. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
I like to think of the deaconess vocation as driven by two things, the love of Christ and the needs of our neighbor.
Issues Etc. regular guest Dr. James Buescher, Director of Deaconess Studies at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, on the vocation of deaconess.
First, the deaconess is moved by the love of Christ, who came not to be served but to serve. Yet I think we can also see the profound needs around us, broken families, loneliness, despair. Deaconesses help the church to become a true family that manifests the love of Christ in our love for one another and especially for those in need.
For more information on the Deaconess Studies program at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, visit ctsfw.edu or call Concordia Theological Seminary at 1-800-481-2155, 800-481-2155. Welcome back to Issues, Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking about the Mayflower Pilgrims. Pastor David J. Weber is our guest. By the way, Pastor Weber and fellow Issues, Etc. regular guest Chris Roseborough and Dr. Joel Heck will be speaking February the 6th and the 7th at a Worldview Conference in San Antonio, Texas. Now, for more information on this conference, click Listen on Demand at issuesetc.org. Pastor Weber, we were talking before about the survival of the Plymouth colonists, but survival is a relative term here. How did that survival actually look after a year or so?
As I mentioned, the Mayflower crossed later in the year than they had originally hoped, and that meant that when they arrived in the New World, they arrived on the cusp of winter. Plus, they were exposed to germs, no doubt, that they previously had not been exposed to, and this resulted in approximately half of the settlers dying during the first year. Now, that a 50% mortality rate might sound like a pretty high mortality rate to us, and I suppose it would be, although in comparison to Jamestown, it was fairly low, because in Jamestown, there was actually a much higher mortality rate overall among the people who had gone there. But still, losing half your number was a great trial to the pilgrims, and there was actually only one household among all of them that was untouched by death during that first winter and during that first year. So there was only about 53 of them left by the time they came to coming close to the first anniversary of their arrival in the New World.
You have mentioned another Puritan colony several times here, the Massachusetts Bay Colony. Compare and contrast Plymouth with that perhaps, at least at the time, more well-established colony.
Yes, Plymouth was settled in 1620, and it was a relatively small colony, originally 102, and it got whittled down to 53. Over the next few years, there were some additional ships that came over and brought over additional settlers, but it still remained a relatively small colony. But then beginning in 1629, there was a much bigger movement of migration of Puritans who were coming directly from England to New England. They established the Massachusetts Bay Colony in 1629, and that colony almost immediately in some ways began to overshadow the Plymouth colony. Now, there were some similarities. The theological outlook of both colonies was very similar, but there were also some differences. In Plymouth, there was much more of a distinction of religious authority and civil authority. William Brewster, who I mentioned before as the man who had been the elder of the Leiden congregation, actually did come with the initial group in 1620, and he exercised a very well-respected religious leadership among the colonists. But the civil leaders were completely different people. After the first governor passed away during the first year, William Bradford was elected as governor of the colony, and he was so good at that job and was so well-respected that he was reelected most years until the year he died. They would have annual elections for governors and other colonial officers, and so he would stand for re-election every year, and most years he was re-elected. Both Brewster and Bradford were, by the way, very learned men. Brewster had studied at Cambridge for a while, although he did not graduate. Bradford was completely self-taught, however, but yet he was a very intellectually curious person. For example, he taught himself how to read Hebrew so that he could read the Old Testament in the original language. We also know what these men and others in the colony had in their libraries, what kinds of books they were reading, because when they would die, the inventories of their estate would be taken, and so were aware of what kinds of books they were reading, the kinds of information they were trying to keep up with in the world. And it's interesting for me as a Lutheran pastor to note that William Bradford had in his library a copy of Martin Luther's commentary on Galatians. Luther's Galatians commentary had been translated into English already in 1575, and it was reprinted several times, and Bradford had a copy of that book in his library. Also, even though he was not a clergyman, Bradford did occasionally write theological treatises, and he wrote one on church polity called The Third Dialogue, and it's interesting to note that Bradford quotes Martin Chemnitz in that treatise. Now, in the Massachusetts Bay Colony, the connection between religious authority and civil authority was not quite so distinct. The clergy exercised a much stronger influence on political matters than was the case in Plymouth. And also, as one difference was that in the Puritan settlements, they were much less hesitant to use coercion in regard to religious matters. Now, remember that in England, the Pilgrims had experienced persecution, and they didn't like it, and they were much more hesitant to persecute other people who would disagree with them. Neither colony allowed the public practicing of a dissenting religion, but the Pilgrims did allow more private practicing of Church of England practices on the part of some of their settlers within the home, whereas in New England there was much more of a strict enforcement of the Puritan way on everyone. And so that there was that difference. A couple other illustrations of the way in which the Plymouth colony was a little more tolerant could be that in the year 1621, when all of the settlers in Plymouth were working together as a part of the process of paying off their debt to the merchant adventurers, they worked as a group. They were not working privately on their own land. And December 25th happened to be scheduled as a regular community work day. As you remember, the Pilgrims, as with the Puritans in general, did not believe in the observance of Christmas, and so they scheduled that day to be just a regular work day. There were some people in their group, however, who still were members of the Church of England. These would have been among those who were recruited by the merchant adventurers, and they objected. They wanted to observe this as a holiday, and so Governor Bradford allowed them to have the day off, as long as they would keep their religious observance of Christmas within the home. But at least he did allow them to do it. And then another very interesting illustration of Plymouth's general patience and personal tolerance comes from the year 1650, many years later, but when Governor Bradford was still the governor. A French Jesuit priest from Canada was in the colony on a diplomatic mission, and he was a dinner guest of Governor Bradford on a Friday. And Governor Bradford was aware of the fact that, as a Catholic, he would not want to eat meat on Friday, and so he made a point of serving him a dinner of fish on that day. So even though Governor Bradford himself would not have had any sympathy with the fasting regulations of the Roman Catholic Church, he still showed respect and personal tolerance toward his guest in that respect on that occasion.
Now, you mentioned earlier on that one of the reasons they stated for actually setting up Plymouth was to kind of be a showcase for the rest of England of what a British Christian society could look like. When do they shift gears a little bit? When do they shift from kind of we're oriented back toward England to now we're oriented toward the new world and our future here?
In the 1640s, a civil war broke out in England, the English Civil War, between royalists and parliamentarians. And the parliamentarians in the English Civil War were largely puritanical or under the influence of the Puritans. And when the parliamentarians prevailed over the royalists and set up the Commonwealth, it took on a very Puritan-type flavor. And so the people in New England, both in Massachusetts Bay and in Plymouth, were hopeful that this was the beginning of the process that they had actually been hoping for, that England itself would be reformed as a society according to God's word as they understood it. But it didn't go well at all. And so finally, in the year 1660, the monarchy was restored, the Commonwealth was abolished, and it was right around that time in 1660 that the New Englanders realized that England's future was not going to be a Puritan future. And that is when they began to see themselves as being somewhat separate from England. And instead of looking to the old world as the reason for their existence, they began to look to the new world. Many other settlers had come to New England in the intervening years. Many other colonies and settlements had been established. And they began to understand gradually that they had a distinct purpose as the fountainhead of a new society in America as compared to the original notion that they would be an outpost of English society.
Well, then let's talk about the first Thanksgiving. Would they have even called it Thanksgiving?
They did not describe what we normally think of as the first Thanksgiving as a Thanksgiving. In contemporary descriptions, it is simply described as 3 days of rejoicing in the good harvest that they had experienced. It was a time of feasting and a time of recreations. Also, there was a large group of Wampanoag Indians from the region who attended. They brought several deer and presented them to the governor so that that meat could be shared with the whole group. The menu that day also included turkey and other fowl. It included corn and barley, but unfortunately, it did not include pumpkin pie or cranberry sauce, at least not on that first occasion. Of course, it is significant to note that since their arrival, they had lost almost half of their number, but yet they were able to find reasons to rejoice in the blessings they had received and to be hopeful for their future with the assurance that God would continue to protect them and bless them. There had been similar harvest festivals in England. At the time of harvest, there would be a community celebration where there would be some innocent fun and communal feasting. And of course, because the pilgrims were very knowledgeable of the scriptures, we can assume that they were very likely inspired in part also by the Old Testament Feast of Tabernacles, which is described in the book of Deuteronomy as a time of rejoicing in the harvest for that year. Another interesting feature of the way in which the book of Deuteronomy describes that Old Testament festival is that it was to include also the strangers and aliens who would be dwelling among the Hebrews. And so the Plymouth settlers seem to have applied this to the Indians who were living in their area. So they were invited to come. They were, of course, continuing to try to cultivate friendly relations with them. And so they were all included. Now, even though religion and the religious beliefs of the pilgrims permeated all aspects of their life, we would not necessarily say that this first harvest festival was a distinctly religious observance. At a later time in New England history, there would be special days of Thanksgiving in a technical sense, that would be called by the colony leaders in response to some specific blessing that had been received from God. And those specific days of thanksgiving, described as by the word thanksgiving, would be largely religious days. They would involve mostly worship and prayer in church and that sort of thing. And those days would not be characterized by the feasting and the recreations. Similarly, at different times when it would be called for, the colony authorities would call for days of humiliation and fasting if there was a particular occasion of a special trial or danger to the colony. So certainly the pilgrims did not observe the first Thanksgiving, as we call it, as an irreligious holiday, but it was mostly and predominantly a community day of celebration of the blessings of life and the joy of life, and also celebrating the good neighborly relations that they had with the Indians. Even though the Indians at that point in history were not Christians, they still celebrated the common blessings of their daily bread with them on that occasion.
Pastor David J. Weber is our guest. We're talking about the Mayflower Pilgrims. It's Wednesday afternoon, November the 26th, on the day in advance of the American celebration of Thanksgiving. We're talking about the ones who did it first. When we come back, how do we know so much about the Mayflower Pilgrims? Thanks to the following congregations for standing with us by joining the Issues Etc. 300. Our Savior Lutheran, Westminster, Massachusetts. Redeemer Lutheran, Fairhope, Alabama. St. Matthew Lutheran, Stony Plain, Alberta, Canada. Holy Cross Lutheran, Moline, Illinois. St. Paul Lutheran, Munster, Indiana. St. John Lutheran, Racine, Wisconsin. Calvary Lutheran, Baltimore, Maryland. Reformation Lutheran, Afton, Missouri. Emmanuel Lutheran, Lima, Ohio. Risen Lord Lutheran, Taylorsville, Kentucky. Prince of Peace Lutheran, Crystal Lake, Illinois. And Trinity Lutheran, Elmore, Ohio. Find out how your church can support this worldwide outreach by including Issues Etc. in your mission or advertising budget. Just go to issuesetc.org, click support, and print the one-page flyer. When your congregation becomes a congregational sponsor, we'll publicize your church on the radio, at our website, and in the Issues Etc. journal, the Issues Etc. 300.
Daily exercise for the Christian mind. You're listening to Issues Etc.
You might wonder, is it possible for my child with special needs to receive a rich classical Christian education? Issues Etc. guest Cheryl Swope answers yes. With the Simply Classical curriculum created by Cheryl and published by Memoria Press, there's no reason to withhold a beautiful education from any struggling student. Visit classicalspecialneeds.com and save $5 on your next order by using the coupon code LPR. Classicalspecialneeds.com.
Folks, we have a little more than 5 weeks left in 2015, and we need approximately $100,000 to cover our expenses for the year. Please consider making a year-end tax-deductible gift to support this worldwide outreach. You can contribute by check, make your check payable to Issues Etc., and send it to Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also make a secure online donation at issuesetc.org. Thanks for listening, and thanks for thinking of us at the end of 2015. We have a children's book, in fact, a children's Christmas book for the Issues Etc. Book of the Month. It's called The Songs of Christmas. It's one of those famous arch books. It includes Mary's Song, the Magnificat, the Songs of the Angels, the Shepherds, Simeon's Song of Praise when Jesus was there in the temple. All of the Christmas story is set to music this way, and you'll find out more about it in this great children's book from the Archbook series from Concordia Publishing House called The Songs of Christmas. Find out more about it at our website, issuesetc.org, or you can give Concordia Publishing House a call, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040. This book is great for kids between ages 2 and 10. It's called The Songs of Christmas, 1-800-325-3040. Pastor Weber, one more question on Thanksgiving. The first one, as you said, was kind of a civic
holiday stretch over a couple days of just kind of, I think we call it today maybe like their maybe a pilgrim's version of a fair, you know, just having a good time with the entire community. How does it become what it is today, a national holiday of Thanksgiving?
Yes, well, the pilgrims and their descendants did regularly observe that kind of community harvest celebration over the years. And then they also occasionally would observe a day of Thanksgiving when there would be some circumstance where that would be called for. But after a while, after a couple generations or so, those two customs did become more or less intertwined and blended together for New Englanders, not only in New England, but also in other places in America where New England settlers eventually had moved to. New Englanders did not celebrate Christmas for a very long time. This was a carryover from that old Puritan idea that it was pagan. So they never observed Christmas. And those regions of America that did celebrate Christmas in the 1700s and 1800s tended not to observe Thanksgiving. Thanksgiving was mostly just something that New England people celebrated, whether in New England or in other places where they had moved to. It was basically one or the other for a community until the 19th century. Thanksgiving became a national holiday by a decree of Abraham Lincoln in 1863. Interestingly enough, Christmas did not start being observed in New England to any great extent until the influx of Irish immigrants in the mid-19th century, who, of course, celebrated Christmas as Catholics. The Puritan and Pilgrim descendants did not join them in this until the late 19th century. So we now in America have both Thanksgiving and Christmas, but in earlier times it was either Thanksgiving for New England people or Christmas for other people.
How were we able to know so much about the Mayflower Pilgrims?
We know a lot about them and their story, largely because of the history of Plymouth Plantation that was written by Governor William Bradford. This was one of the earliest historical writings in American history. He wrote a meticulous account of the things that happened. He talked about the people involved, the things that motivated them. And fortunately, that history has survived. It was passed down in the family for several generations, and you can actually track its possession through some will records among his descendants. And eventually it was published, and now everybody has access to that story. In fact, I would even say, too, in speaking of this history, that two key quotes might help us to understand this story. These quotes could be thought of perhaps as the bookends of the pilgrim story. The first one is describing the time when they were getting ready to depart from Holland in order to go back to England just for a very short time in order to board the Mayflower and then come to America. And this is the way he described what happened then and what their feelings were at the time. So they left that goodly and pleasant city, which had been their resting place near 12 years, but they knew they were pilgrims and looked not much on those things, but lifted up their eyes to the heavens, their dearest country, and quieted their spirits. And then I guess the second bookend would be more or less a retrospective on the colony, as Bradford was now looking forward to the legacy that this colony would have for their descendants and for the whole country. And this is what he says in that regard. May not and ought not the children of these fathers rightly say, our fathers were Englishmen, which came over this great ocean, and were ready to perish in this wilderness. But they cried unto the Lord, and he heard their voice, and looked on their adversity, etc. Let them therefore praise the Lord, because he is good, and his mercies endure forever. So you can see how the faith of Bradford and the faith of the pilgrims permeated their self-understanding from beginning to end. As they were launching out on this adventure, they knew that they were pilgrims and that the Lord would be watching over them and protecting them. And then as they were reflecting on the success of this venture, they were grateful to the Lord for the blessings that he had given them in it. As we're mentioning Bradford, I suppose I can also mention that I have a very personal interest in him and his insights and the way in which he described these things, because both my wife and I are actually direct descendants of William Bradford. My wife is also a descendant of William Brewster, the elder of the congregation. And interestingly enough, she is a descendant of John Robinson, the pastor of the Leiden congregation, who would be considered the theological founder of Congregationalism. As I mentioned, he never came to the colony, but one of his sons did, and my wife is a descendant of that son. Our own son, who is recently ordained, is therefore, to the best of my knowledge, the only Lutheran pastor who is a direct descendant of the founder of Congregationalism.
Pastor David J. Weber is pastor of Redeemer Lutheran Church in Scottsdale, Arizona. It's been fascinating, David. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We're going to continue our Thanksgiving theme in the next hour of Issues, Etc., talking with Pastor Peter Bender of the Concordia Catechetical Academy about the Lord's Prayer, the petition, Give Us This Day Our Daily Bread. Folks, if you're thankful for the worldwide outreach of Issues, Etc., please consider making a special Thanksgiving gift. You can donate online, issuesetc.org. You can also make a special Thanksgiving contribution by check. Make that check payable to Issues, Etc., and send it to Issues, Etc., Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. The address again, Issues, Etc., Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Thanks for listening, and thanks for your support all year long. I'm Todd Wilkin. More Issues, Etc., right after the break.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Issues Etc., P.O. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.
Do you wish your Lutheran school offered Latin, Greek, or logic? What about German or calculus? Right now, local Lutheran schools in two different states are utilizing Wittenberg Academy to expand their course offerings. Whether it's Latin for third graders or logic for seniors in high school, Wittenberg Academy can help. For your homeschooler or for your brick-and-mortar Lutheran school, we have solutions. To find out more, visit wittenbergacademy.org.